You're about to listen to the Complete Developer Podcast, the podcast by coders, for coders, about all aspects of life as a developer.
I'm Will, the curmudgeonly experienced developer.
And I'm Beege, the optimistic newbie developer.
Complete Developer Podcast is supported by listeners like you. We are now on Patreon at www.patreon.com/completedeveloperpodcast.
Welcome to another episode. This week, we're discussing application design mistakes that a lot of us make. These aren't simple things like bugs. Instead, they're the sort of insidious design decisions that get right past QA and into production. But before we get started, Will, what have you been fighting this week?
I am playing whack-a-mole with bugs. We have a page that I was told needed to work one way, and then I found out late last week that maybe not quite. And I'd raised the issue before because the way it's going to be working now is what I thought it should be, and then I got kind of overruled, and then it's switched back. So I'm having to go through and clean up a bunch of code.
I understand that.
Yeah, to handle the new model, and a lot of it is some knockout JS stuff calling back to an ASP.NET web form, and using web methods and all the fun that goes there. Holy. And, so it's like I fix an issue where, I can't delete this thing. And then it goes, would you like another record? And so I had to go find that. And then it's like, now it's not saving at all. So I fixed that. Now it's corrupted data.
Oh, man.
And it was constant whack-a-mole. I got to like 3:30 this afternoon and I just stopped. I just sat and looked at my computer for like 10 minutes. It's one of those deals where you go kind of walk around and see how everybody else is doing, if they need help, because you just can't.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I kind of understand that because this past weekend I was working on stuff and I spent about an hour and a half or so trying to figure out what was wrong with the API. So I was getting basically the object was not an instance of an object. And what I found out was it had nothing to do with the API because all my API tests worked. And when I used Postman, it worked. Guess what it was? A typo.
In your JavaScript.
In the controller that was calling the factory that was calling the API.
Awesome.
Yes. And it was a typo on the name of the object that was being sent in. So it was basically sending nothing or a null object when
it was a different thing. I guess you have like a bag of state that you're basically passing. Well, that's what a JavaScript object kind of is anyway.
Yeah, pretty much.
And when you get the key name just slightly wrong, which is your property name, mm-hmm. You get burned. Because we have this goober that's no longer employed with us. It means before my time, who could not spell things. And it was like, okay, I'll misspell this in the table name. And then let me make a stored procedure. Oh, wait, the table name is misspelled. So I'll make the stored procedure name that uses that table misspelled. And then I'll have an entity framework class, for both of those things that will also be misspelled. And then I'll make a business object. And, so it's consistent. I'll misspell that. And then eventually you're pitching stuff into JavaScript that's misspelled. And you want to talk about hard to find errors. And every time I find one of those, I spend like 2 hours fixing it because it's everywhere. And mm-hmm. there'll be little stupid stuff like data binding. And I have to do it. Like you have to search in the ASP.NET code, which is not hard with Visual Studio. And you can find it in JavaScript code the mm-hmm. same way. In the database, you have to actually go and like query information schema and find stored procedures that have that text in them.
Oh, wow.
And then go fix all those places.
Do you guys use like a developer suite for your database?
No.
Oh.
I hand roll the queries when I need them. I've gotten really fast at it now, so it doesn't matter that much. But it's a little horrendous. So
you guys might look into something like Toad.
Yeah, Toad's nice. We're on SQL.
Oh.
But at this point, I've done so much meta programming with SQL Server that that's just a blip on my radar at this point. It just doesn't. It's just tedious. But anyway, we're at the final little bit, and of course, the buck stops here, and you chase the bugs everywhere they go. It's very tiring. You like take a couple of aspirin, throw back a 5-hour energy drink and go at it. How about you?
Well, I am stepping to the Imperial March, the Death March at the moment. We are at this point one day away from finishing this project. I'm going to be up all night tonight finishing just a few things on it that development is due tomorrow. And so We've got all the backlog complete, but we did have to make some changes to a few of the views just to create a better flow. And so I'm going to be working on one of the big kind of processes tonight. Our front-end developer, who's our lead front-end developer, has kind of redesigned the whole thing when we found out we had to, and has been working even more than I have, you know, staying up all night most nights the last 2 weeks.
Yeah, you've been getting burnt pretty bad here lately.
So I'm looking forward to after tomorrow when we're not working on this project anymore.
To having another one dumped on your lap.
Well, you know what? I've got a week, and he and I are both working on this other project. We're the two developers on it. We've got a really great working relationship. It's Cody, by the way, that was here. So just so everybody else knows, we work really well together, and we're on this next project together. And really, I'm kind of looking forward to it because I think between the two of us, we'll be able to get stuff done.
Yeah.
And we're spending the time. We learned a lot from the last project we were on, and we're trying to learn from the mistakes we made on that one and not make those again, so we can make all new mistakes.
Oh, like Jurassic Park 2.
Yeah.
Sorry, we watched that a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know.
So,
with that said, let's go ahead and roll the music. So I've been talking a lot lately about projects that you can do for or with your kids or the kids in your life. This one is something that you can do for the seniors in your life. It's basically a smart pill bottle that will help both doctors and patients. You know, in the project, you'll put a sensor on the top to monitor when the bottle is opened, and it helps track time patterns of when pills are taken. And you can also put a sensor on it to tell when it's time to get a refill. It's a pretty neat little project, and there will be a link to it in the show notes. Who's talking to us this week?
Well, we got an email from Toby Mitchell, who was actually in my office last week. He works at one of our clients, and he says, "Keep up the great work. You both have great radio voices and speech cadences to go with really good perspectives. Enjoying new episodes and working back on my long drive."
Thanks, Toby. We've got faces to match those voices. That is to say, faces for radio.
Yes.
But shoot us an email with your address, because we've got a complete developer water bottle just for you. And guys, if you'd like your very own complete developer water bottle, leave us a review in iTunes or comment on the website or any of our social media. We post all of our episodes to Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and Google+, and we're also on Path and Tumblr. As we've been doing, I want to remind everybody that our friend Bethany Adams has released her second book. And so to celebrate, we're running another contest where we'll be giving away an autographed copy of one of her books. It'll be the winner's choice, and we'll be announcing the winner the first episode in May. To enter, all you have to do is leave us a review in iTunes. We really love seeing those 5 stars.
So the reason we wrote up this episode is, you know, you have things like test-driven development, you have QA processes, you have user acceptance testing, that sort of thing. And those are mostly intended to catch, you know, programming errors, logic errors, things that make your app not work. But there's really another category of mistakes that developers make when we're building applications. And that category of mistakes can really damage the user experience. What really makes it even more nasty and insidious is that the typical development process can often mask these problems. So it makes it where you don't actually see that something is an issue because you're down in the software looking at it all the time.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things that doesn't really come out until it's in production.
Yeah, then somebody's like, "Why does it do this? This is so awful." And you're like, "Oh, I spent all this time coding this."
Hopefully you catch it in UAT.
If you have UAT, yeah.
We should be having UAT. That's just that.
Yeah, we're like,
I'm messing with you. You know what?
There's lots of people that have trouble just having quality assurance.
Yeah, I was going to say it's one of those things that I kind of understand, because we're trying to get, even though we're developing products for other divisions within our department, we're trying to get them on board with UAT or at least pilot testing.
Yeah.
What we've learned, if you don't have that, it may pass all the criteria and then be horrendous to actually use.
Well, and it's really easy for developers because we're so used to the software and the way that we think and we know what's required for stuff and all that. Mm-hmm. And we tend to develop a little bit of a blind spot over time. And that's part of the reason I don't like testing my own stuff is because like I've looked at it long enough. It's like somebody figuring out that their own kid is ugly. Like they're just not going to do it. And I could go, oh, that kid's ugly because, you know, I'm around him all the time. Which, you know, I mean, our parents don't call us ugly. And so see, proof of concept.
Wait, your parents don't call you ugly?
Usually no.
Oh, lucky you.
So your parents have better UAT, obviously.
Apparently so. But to get into it, we'll put together a list of 10 anti-patterns that we're going to go over with you. And these are just things that you need to look at when you're designing your application.
Yeah, and it's basically stuff. It's like your application is functional, but you're just pissing people off.
Which, it's interesting that you put this together because this is part of what I'm going to be working on tonight. All of the functionality is there.
Is writing these anti-patterns?
Yes, writing anti-patterns. No, all of the functionality is there, but when we started UAT and had some other people look at it, they pointed out that the flow wasn't very smooth. Like you were jumping back and forth to the main page to do stuff that should just flow straight through. And so that's what this rewrite that Cody and I have been doing the last couple of weeks, trying to get it done in time for the deadline. But that's just, it's interesting that you do this and it's the night before that's due.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and it's on my mind too with what I'm doing.
Yeah. Because that's true, you got one coming out.
Yeah. And I've never worked on an app that hasn't had at least one of these.
Yeah.
And one of them in particular.
Mm-hmm. So to get started, first off is incessant notifications. Hey, pay attention to me.
Yeah. And the thing is when you're testing your code, what's the most important thing on your machine? It's the code, right? It's the little app that you built. Well, when somebody's using your app, what's the most important thing on their machine? Possibly not your code. In fact, quite likely in a pretty good chunk of circumstances. And so this kind of gets down to the problem that like vendors of microwave ovens and washing machines and all that kind of stuff have, because they all make audible notifications.
Well, yeah. I mean, if I'm microwaving something and I go sit to watch TV while it's in the microwave for 5 minutes, I want it to ding and tell me it's done.
Yeah. Once.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're in a lab testing it, you're like, oh, it dinged and they didn't respond. They're obviously in another room or something. And so if I don't ding every so often to remind them, they'll forget that they have pizza in the microwave. It's like, dude, your house smells like garlic and pepperoni. You're not forgetting that there's a pizza in the microwave, okay? And it's very easy to get that bias and go, oh, the app is the most important thing. And so you'll see that with, like, they're starting to kind of realize this with devices. It's like, this really irritates people.
I'll tell you where you do want it, though. Alarm clocks.
Well, yeah. You do.
Threw you off on that one, huh?
Yeah. Just as an aside, I really find if I lived alone and I had the alarm clock I have now, I would open it up and disconnect the snooze button. And the reason is I'm like, this defeats the purpose of the device. You know, but, you know, like I have this problem with my washing machine and dryer, dishwasher and bread maker and microwave. They all do this and they'll beep or they'll make some little noise. Like my washing machine, I was watching TV the other night, and when it gets done, it goes dee 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 dee, and it does that.
My mom just does that too.
Once every 30 seconds. And the dryer does the same thing. That's great when you're building those, you know, when you're designing those in a lab. Practical application, you just tick people off. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean.
B just making fun of me right now over text because there's no R in wash. Fair enough. The dryer does the same thing, you know?
There is an R in that word.
Yeah.
Sorry. I have to pick because I grew up not too far away from you, and I used to do it too, and
I can't get rid of that. Like, it's
neither can he who should not be named and quite a few of our other friends that grew up around here or in the South.
Well, that and, you know, putting three syllables in the word fish. Fish.
Going fishing.
Thankfully I got rid of that one.
Yeah. Anyway, so, but like, this is really painful with desktop notifications.
Yes. Like Dropbox. Goodness. I mean, I finally had to turn all those off.
Oh, yeah.
Dropbox, Hangouts, C-File, the Linux updates. Let's see, the battery notifications, all that stuff. NVIDIA, their little update notifications.
Or, you know, when you're using Chrome and Windows pops up with Edge is more secure, or Edge could do this. And you're like, what?
Hey, kid, you want to try some Edge?
Yeah, it's exactly what it's like.
I promise you it won't cause possession by the Prince of Darkness. And actually, it does, because you're still on Windows. Anyway. Yeah, I've been seeing, you know, but what's odd is I see those on occasion on my Linux boxes.
Really?
Yeah, the little ads that are like that. And I'm like, you guys can't target anything. You know?
See, it's not an ad. It's actually a Windows notification.
Oh, you get the Windows notifications. I've seen ads.
Okay, yeah.
So maybe that makes that. Well, I mean, if they got in on Linux, I would be real upset.
Yeah.
Like, that's when I grow the beard out to my knees and switch to BSD. Like, that's it. But, you know, Facebook notifications. I mean, like, you think about just how often you're subjected to notifications from everything.
Well, I hate that, like, Facebook, for example, you know, you got the little notification thing that tells you how many you've got. What I hate is every time I join a group or I like a page or something like that, it's automatically turned on to receive all notifications.
Yes.
And I have to go in and manually turn that off.
Well, and the biggest part of this is the disruption, right? Because, like, Facebook, when you get a messenger message, it pops up with dude's face floating over whatever else is on your phone. You got to drag it out of your way. It's like, hey, I use my phone for stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And that's the biggest thing with notifications is that it's that visual distraction versus the auditory distraction you get with devices.
Or if you're, you know, playing a game on your phone and
it kicks you out.
Yeah. All of a sudden, Twitter decides it's going to update its notifications because it does that randomly.
Yeah. And kills your bandwidth and your battery, too.
Yeah.
And so this is something to think about, right? Because if your app is doing this all the time, you need something in there to throttle notifications and basically say, hey, I'm going to put you in a box and you're going to go away because I don't care that you want to notify me about some crap. And so you need to think about that when you're building an app. So, number two is excessive ceremony for setup.
Yeah, your app may work if all the pieces are lined up, but how long does it take to actually get going with your software?
Yeah, because like if your onboarding / setup process is really lengthy, and there's some software that you just can't avoid that with. You know,
yeah, like a new OS.
Yeah, like if you're building Arch from nothing, like you're gonna be there a while and you know that. Mm-hmm. But when you're going, okay, I wanna get into MailChimp and I wanna send emails, like that needs to happen pretty fast.
Yes, and it's one of those things that you may not do the full setup. You need to be able to do a quick setup.
Yeah, and get enough done to get something done.
Yes, minimum viable product.
Yeah, or minimum, it's minimum viable setup.
Yeah, that's good.
Effectively, like that. Because, hey, you know, good enough is good enough. Because usually if somebody's getting into your software, it's because they need to get in there. It's not because, oh, I need to get in there 3 weeks from now, because people don't plan ahead. Look at our national debt. Look at how many people are totally screwed when there's a natural disaster. We don't plan ahead. So
look at our show outlines. Will wrote this today.
There is that.
But seriously, though, excessive setup efforts, they tend to get missed a lot in QA because it's already set up.
Yeah. And they set up scenarios and then they repeatedly use those. Right. So like they're not going through the nasty experience of getting all those pieces together. And, you know, the biggest thing is just remembering that your app is there because it provides value to someone, not necessarily to the users, but even if it provides value to your boss and not to the users, you want that experience to be as quick as possible so that you get the value. And this, and just to go into another aside, like, please, if you are building an e-commerce site, don't make it hard for me to pay you.
Yeah, that's the quickest, easiest way to not make money.
Well, I mean, you'll make money eventually, but I will have my erect middle finger pointed at the screen and type one-handed just to flip you off the entire time because you irritate me so bad.
Yeah, I'll just go find another vendor.
Yeah, if you can. But, like, why stand in the way of somebody handing you money? Like, when you're looking at it like that, it shows how stupid that is.
For an example of a good way to do it, look at Amazon. They've even got one-click buying for their Amazon products.
Yes, although I have had problems with Amazon where it's got the wrong data in there and they kept putting the wrong thing.
Yeah.
And it created extra effort because they were screwing up.
You're going to have that
kind
of thing everywhere. But their overall structure, their design for their payment system, I really like.
Yeah. Because, I mean, you know, like, not to quote the movie Idiocracy, but I like money. Right? Like, if you've got an e-commerce site, you kind of want that to happen fairly quickly.
Yeah. Moving on, number three, dumb auto update practices. We're looking at you, Windows.
Yes, we are. And we're glaring and judging you.
If your app automatically updates, it must be rock solid, unobtrusive, emphasis, 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 and capable of being deferred.
Also, trace emphasis.
Yes.
Again, looking at you, Microsoft Windows.
Yeah.
10.
We've had some issues. We had a guest in studio. Thankfully, he was a friend of ours, but Windows decided to update. And we
lost the whole evening.
Yeah.
And, you know, this has happened to me at work. I think one of the editors of CNET got burned this week. You know, he's getting ready for like a major presentation or something, and Windows forced an update on him right beforehand, and he was just dead in the water. Like, these kind of practices are really dumb. Yes, I understand you want to update your clients. You know, there's a security thing, or we have a new version of the API, but you need to realize people are using the computer for what they want, and they don't care about you.
Well, it's their computer, not yours.
Yeah. And it's a fundamental misunderstanding of modern software vendors that they think that, oh, well, if I have software running on your computer, I own it. And that is a surefire way to alienate people. You know how many people I've talked to that are like, hey, how hard is it to switch to Linux?
Oh, yeah.
Like, Windows is getting so bad that there are grandmothers learning how to do stuff on the command line.
Yeah. One is my mother.
Yeah. And I mean, like, you think about that from a marketing perspective. It's like, you are so bad. This is where we are. I don't know of another way to put that and sound like there's no way I can put that without a lot of profanity and get the point across any better.
Also, if your app interacts with an API, don't roll out changes to your API that are not backward compatible with your app.
Yeah, because I've seen plenty of them that are like, oh, hey, we'll roll an API update and then we'll force everybody to upgrade. Okay, well, first of all, that's risky because what happens if your new API doesn't handle the load? For some reason, everybody's down.
Not seen that anytime recently. Blueberry.
Yeah. Yeah. How about that? Blueberry. I'm sorry. That's extremely frustrating. I mean, the other thing, too, is a lot of people can't update immediately. And so if you say, hey, we're rolling out an API update, the previous one's deprecated and you have to update right now, you just made, you know, you screwed everybody. And it's particularly bad, like, if you're, I don't know, your download server is really slow. Mm-hmm. Like, just be considerate about your users and how long they're sitting there waiting on your stupid update when they have other things to do.
You got to think about what your users are trying to do with your software, with your app. You don't want to be constantly breaking their workflow, and especially if you're reminding them of updates.
Yeah, and like Windows was doing this for a while where it would pop up a thing, do you want to upgrade to Windows 10? And it would pop it up over other stuff, which we'll get into in a minute. But like that's another anti-pattern, and usually these kind of patterns tend to be a grab bag.
Yeah. Now, I'll say this. One thing I like is when they send out, because my work machine is managed by, you know, work.
Yeah.
When they do updates, they send it out and it's in 8 hours, this laptop is going to restart, and you can just move that out of the way and you never see it. It doesn't keep pestering you. It tells you once. You get the option to refresh right there or restart right then, or, you know, you can wait, but it tells you 8 hours and then has a countdown. And I like that because that's convenient. It's usually, you know, so that if I turn my computer on when I get to work, it basically says, all right, in 8 hours, we're going to restart this computer. And I'm like, oh, so that means when I leave, I need to make sure and shut my computer down a couple minutes early so it has time to
do its thing.
And you know, that's nice. It's nice to know that so I can plan my day around it. But it's not obtrusive. It pops up once. The hide button doesn't work that well all the time, but I can always just kind of move it off to the side and not see it. Yeah,
behind everything.
Yeah.
The other thing, too, is like it's important to note that this has to be rock solid. I mean, we've had a problem with Windows updating drivers. And, you know, it'll update grandma's NVIDIA driver. And then suddenly her desktop computer doesn't work anymore.
Yeah.
And you have to do all the, you know, you have to do the little safe mode chicken dance. And you've got, you know, you got a Toshiba laptop. So, of course, you can't get into the BIOS and do anything. And,
yeah,
you know, it's like you have to vet this stuff. You're pushing code to run on other people's machines like that. If you don't do that, that's the equivalent of going into their house and defecating on their rug.
Pretty
with
much.
Guests. They have a right to beat you with a table if you do that. Like, that's completely reasonable. Yeah. So, like, don't do that.
Next is the inability to save and recover work in progress.
This is one that every app I've worked on just about has missed. Like, if you're going through a fairly complicated process, you need it to hold on to what you're doing. Because, mm-hmm. you know, life happens.
Yeah. I mean, if your user is working in your app and they experience a power failure, network connectivity failure, or
their kid comes running in the room covered in blood because they got into an accident in the yard, they shouldn't lose work.
Now, I had a couple of questions when you first sent me this, so I'm going to go ahead and ask them. Like, what about working with web apps, like in the browser web apps?
Well, there's local browser storage, and so you can store updates there. The pattern I've seen in the past has been to basically kind of fake a message queue in the browser. And so you write to that message queue, and then you process it.
Well, what happens if you get a power outage while your user's working on stuff?
Well, like, nothing's going to be perfect.
Yeah.
Right? But if you write to it, you know, you do it quick enough, like, nobody's going to say, oh, the power went out. Like, right then, and the thing I was, you know, the last four keystrokes before the power went out, like, they're not going to expect those to be there, because they're not going to remember it anyway, because they probably kept typing for a second. So, like, you're clear there. But if you store it in the browser and you can bring it back up, and you still have that in your app, then catches up and reprocesses and pushes stuff in, you can usually get away with it.
Okay.
It's the same thing that, like, Excel or Visual Studio or Word or any of these apps do, where they'll dump stuff off to the disk.
What about with... You know, when you're working behind a firewall or something, you know, you have to log in just to get to the app.
Browser local storage is browser local storage, right? Like, it doesn't start processing until after you're logged in.
What I'm saying is, logging back in, will it still be able to get to that?
Yeah. You know, there's ways.
I haven't played around with browser storage
much. Yeah, there's ways to do that kind of stuff where, I mean, just think about the use cases for what happens to somebody when they partially complete something. And this actually goes to another design thing as well. Like, I don't know if you're familiar with, like, how, like, users typically set up accounts, right? And you know how annoying it is when you have, like, 500 fields to fill out.
Mm-hmm.
What if you just let your users fill out a minimum and then you periodically, like, prompt them for other stuff as it's needed and store it? You gradually, you know, in aggregate, you still get the full user profile, but you don't tie them up for an extended period of time.
Well, I like things like with your social media where you get the first things you fill out are the required fields.
Yeah.
What you have to have an account. And then it kind of walks you through the process of how to use it along with filling that out. And you can hit skip.
Yeah. And it's a gradual onboarding process. Mm-hmm. Like, that works a whole lot better for actually getting users to essentially convert and use the app.
Yeah. Like, when you open a new Facebook account, first thing you have to enter is your email address and create a password, because those are required.
And your name.
And, yeah, and your name.
Where your location is, I think. There's one or two other things.
It's just the required stuff. And then it goes through the different things. Like, all right, enter your education and where you work. And it lets you just skip those.
Yeah.
And it'll even say, you know, skip and come back to later. Well, it used to. I don't know. It's been a while since I've started a Facebook account. But, you know, it. I remember that. And I'm like, I liked that flow, because two parts, it introduced me to the way their app worked, but it also got me through that process stepwise.
Yeah, and you could come back to it later, because mm-hmm. you're trying to get to the point where you get value as well. And this one gets missed by QA, because what does QA do? They test end to end.
Yeah.
They don't go, oh, I'm going to stop in the middle and come back. And it's just very easy to have that bias and miss that.
Exactly.
The next one is poor idle practices. And this is what your app does when it's in the background, when your machine goes into hibernate mode, potentially, those kinds of things. In other words, how does your app behave when it is not the focus?
Yeah, your app, if it's in the background, it should not be using CPU, memory, and disk.
At least at a high rate.
Yeah, in the same way as when it's in the foreground. What I love, just absolutely love, is when you turn your laptop on and everything's, you know, like it takes forever to load up and stuff like that. You click on your task manager and you got nothing running. I've opened no apps and the disk is at 100%.
Yep.
For an hour.
And or the network is at it, or yeah, you know, it's chewing up memory. Like today, Google Hangouts did this to me. And that's actually why I wrote this point in there. Because it suddenly decided, for some reason, it's like, even though nobody, like, you hadn't sent me a message this morning yet. Like, no, literally no one had contacted me on Google Hangouts since yesterday when you sent me a message. And it was using, I think, 3,200 megabytes mm-hmm. of RAM. It's Hangouts. Yeah. Just because, you know, hey, whatever.
I don't know. I've been having issues just getting Google Hangouts to turn on.
Yeah.
On my machine at work.
I mean, they got something going on, but you don't, like, unless your app is designed to be a background app, you really don't need that going on. And this actually kicks back into the Windows thing, right? Because I've also had problems with Windows updates, which is a background process, suddenly deciding, hey, I need most of your CPU. It's like, that's great that you want to check for that, but if I'm recording and I need real-time audio streaming, or I'm, you know, doing something critical, you know, or I'm playing a video and just, you know, farting around and drinking beer, I don't want you to pull my machine down to nothing because you up and decided you want to do something and it's not my focus right now.
Yeah.
It's just rude. Like, most of these things are just rudeness.
That's very true. But basically, your app really needs to recognize when it isn't the most important thing on the system, and you should make sure that it doesn't interfere with whatever is the most important thing.
Yeah, and your app also needs to be able to handle system hibernation events. This isn't as critical on the web, you know, because you kind of got some limits on what you can actually do. But if it's a desktop app and the machine goes into hibernate mode, like, that should not corrupt state. Like, you get a message that says, "Hey, we're going into hibernate mode. You got a minute? Get your stuff sorted. You know, serialize whatever you got to serialize to disk. Handle it." And this can actually be an issue, like, if you're doing stuff with timers. Because you'll come back and it's been like 50 hours since you went into hibernate mode. Like, you can't base stuff off of that anymore. So you do have to kind of take some conscious steps, but they're things that you should be doing anyway.
That makes perfect sense. Next is poor error handling practices. Yep. Your error messages should describe what is going on in a way that your average user can troubleshoot it, at least for common errors.
Yeah. I mean, you're not going to get everything, right? Like, if there's some weird file system error and, you know, some of those things are just going to bubble up and they can't be handled. But if it's something that's like, they, you know, it's a typical misconfiguration thing, you just tell them, hey, here's how you fix this.
Well, that should be part of your documentation too, and Googleable.
Yeah.
Notice I didn't say searchable. I said Googleable because.
Yeah. Or Bingable, if you really want to get, you know.
Bingable.
Yeah, that is, they really didn't pick a good verb for that. but, you know, you want to have in-app documentation for this kind of stuff so that your users aren't frustrated.
Exactly.
I mean, you know, that's the main goal. And it's really not, it's not as hard to do as people like to act like it is.
And you shouldn't hide errors that lead to data corruption or basically things not getting saved.
Yeah, and I've had this problem on the app that I'm building because the previous developer was like, oh, we don't ever want a ASP.NET yellow screen, which we don't.
No.
But his solution was, I'll catch an exception and swallow it and not save things. And so you put a bunch of stuff in and you come back and it's not there. It's like, this could be hours of somebody's work. I mean, like, it's a document, you know, it's a document composition tool. And, you know, the previous developer's not there anymore. So, of course, the first thing I did is I stripped out all his stupid error handling and then actually fixed the common, you know, cases. And it doesn't do that anymore.
Yeah.
And the next one is poor timeliness. Basically, the point here is that your app needs to respond in a reasonable amount of time to something that someone does. And, you know, and this is just good programming. Like, you click a button, you should get something going, okay, I'm doing the thing, not wait 10 minutes and then I'm going to pop up a dialogue. Says, oh yeah, by the way, we did the thing. Like, that ought to be you know, that ought to be immediate. And it's like, oh, well, you know, that requires another thread. It's like, I don't care. Do it so the user knows what's going on. Because what ends up happening if you don't do it is they keep clicking that button. And you get all kinds of weird data corruption and all kinds of support problems.
So I have a funny story to tell here on this one. Where I learned this was early on in the app that we're working on. One of the first sprints that I worked on, we built this one piece, you know, vertical slice front all the way to the database kind of thing. And QA is testing it. And nothing happened when you clicked save. Well, something happened, but nothing happened on the screen.
Yeah.
And so he was like freaking out and just like hitting save like 100 times. I'm like, dude, stop. Every time you hit save, it's resaving it.
Yeah.
And I explained this to him. Then 2 days later, he comes back to me and because he was testing the search functionality that we had. And he's like, why am I getting 100 of the same?
Yeah.
And I'm like, it's because you hit the save button 100 times when I told you to stop doing it.
Well, I mean, and that actually dovetails with the other thing too, right? Like when somebody clicks a save or a, I want to buy this now, the first thing you do is you disable the button before you even send it to the server because you want to stop that. Because otherwise, you know, somebody, like if somebody got frustrated on Amazon with the, you know, the one, you know, one click purchase stuff and they went nuts clicking, it's like, hey, I've got 45 electric toothbrushes now.
Or
because I went nuts on clicking.
If you experience the problem that I had when I moved of forgetting to change the address associated with your debit card on the app you're using so that the card information is right, but the address is wrong.
Yep.
When you do that, when you have a customer that does that, your app should not still bill them and block their access to their account or to that money because it does. It'll block off that money pending authorization for 2 or 3 days.
Yeah. And you can really nail yourself, especially like with repeat attempts. I mean, this is just, you know.
You have very, very angry customers that call you and fuss at you because why isn't this working? And then they find out why it's not working. They still can't use your app because your app has taken all their money and is holding it hostage for days.
And a lot of that can happen because they clicked multiple times because you didn't give them a feedback mechanism to see that, hey, we got it. The other thing is, I don't know how low level you've gotten looking at the way Windows does things, but you have a message loop. And so you're basically looping and going, hey, do I have any messages? Hey, do I have any messages? And you get one and it's like, okay, I got this message. I got to do the thing.
Yeah.
And it's got a payload and all that stuff like at a very low level. Because of that, because that's in one thread, you can't push stuff into that off of another thread without going through some effort. And so what ends up happening is people go, okay, when I click a button, I'm going to do this other thing. But the update of the screen is a Windows message. And so it's waiting for you to re-enter that loop, the outer loop, and you're in a function hanging off of it. And as a result, you don't update the screen. So what you actually want to do is you want to spool off another thread and do the thing that you're trying to do and immediately send the Windows message that tells it to update.
I follow you. Okay.
And sloppy programmers don't do that because, hey, that's a lot of extra effort. You know, even with the newer threading constructs in .NET, it's rough. And you have all the issues with threading because now you got to update the screen from another thread. And so you can get into some really weird circumstances there, especially if they're still able to click on other things and you have global variables because you know, if you're sloppy in one place, you're sloppy in 10. So, I mean, that's why that exists, but we got to get past that. That doesn't need to be going on.
Mm-hmm. Next is poor rollbacks.
Oh, those poor rollbacks.
I'm sorry. An app should allow undoing actions to the degree possible.
Yeah. I mean, there's some things that it's like, you know, nuclear missile launched, like it's not going to land back on the rocket pad. Okay. Like that's not happening, you know, but for other things, you should allow a rollback. Well, okay, if Elon Musk designs a nuclear rocket, then it might come back down and land, but you still have an explosive payload attached to, you know, something, and you're just landing it right by you. That's not like you want it to go away. but for most things, you really don't want a situation where a user can do something like, I don't know, deleting a record and doing a hard delete out of a database and not being able to go, oh, wait, I didn't mean to do that. Because when you do that, inevitably somebody is going to screw up and do it. You know, they're going to get confused. They're going to be drunk at work. You know, you have a broad enough base of users, like all kinds of random crap happens. So you've got to have undo capability. This is why typically in apps, I don't like to delete ever. I have a flag that says is deleted. You know, they can get stuff out of a view that checks and, you know, checks that flag and says, okay, if it's deleted, I'm not returning it to you, but it's still there. You know, for that very reason.
Well, I mean, because I work for the state, we really don't delete anything.
Yeah.
It goes into an audit table.
Yeah.
So it can be recovered, except for a few things like lookup tables and, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah. Well, the big thing is, like, you're familiar with accounting practices, right? Like, mm-hmm. They'll tell you an accountant does not use an eraser. It's because, oh, I got this wrong. I'm going to put an adjusting entry in there.
Exactly.
So that there's an audit trail.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a smarter way to do things because then you can roll back.
Well, it's like if your bank accidentally overcharges you for something, they don't go back and adjust the charge.
Yeah.
They give you money.
Right.
You know, they put money in as an adjustment, which is the same kind of thing. But
yeah, it's the idea that, hey, look, you did this thing. It's done, but it's not permanent. Like we can fix it, but we don't have time machines.
Well, like a good example of this is when I got the bank account that I have now. Yeah, y'all know I went through a divorce and everything and all that jazz. So when I got this bank account, I had started working and the bank account was going to be free once I started receiving direct deposit. Until then, I had a monthly charge. And I think it was about a month before direct deposit went into effect. Like it takes time for them to process it and all that jazz. But so I got charged the first month. Second month, I got charged. And then immediately, it got refunded. Like there was an entry for, you know, monthly maintenance fee, and then monthly maintenance fee refunded. That went on, like it was like one right after the other.
Yeah.
Instantly. That went on for probably about 2 or 3 months. And I don't know if it was just the bank's system going, all right, let's make sure he's getting direct deposit consistently or what. But that went on for a while before they finally stopped doing that. Yeah. But it was one right after the other because that's.
Yeah. And you want to be able to roll back stuff. Either, you know, like this is, you know, what you're talking about is automated. But the other thing is, like, if I go to delete a record.
Well, yeah.
Now, there's another caveat with this. If your user can do multiple actions in a row. Mm-hmm. You don't, you know, like in short order, you don't want to just have one level of undo. Windows Notepad is the worst for this, right? I type something. Oh, crap, that was bad. Undo. Well, if the thing I was doing is more than one step back, I can't undo it. It's there. Yeah. Like, so you have to, the number of undo levels you have to allow or the number of rollback levels has to be a reasonable quantity based on what you're doing. Because otherwise, it's not a real rollback. That's one that'll catch people. Obviously, I mean, it caught the people that wrote Notepad, that, and, you know, they got a text editor up and they didn't care anymore because once it's stable, you leave that alone.
Yeah. That's, yeah.
The next one is poor focus management. And this is what we were talking about with Windows. The focus is the app or the control that is currently receiving input. And that's pretty much common across any operating system that stole ideas from Xerox PARC, yeah. You know, which is all of them now. Yeah. Something is getting the input. When you type, where does it go? That's the focus. Mm-hmm. If your app pops up and takes focus away from something somebody else is doing, that's real bad. Windows has gotten where they kind of stop a lot of that stuff, except with their own updates.
Oh, they're so annoying with this. What I hate is when you're in the middle, when you're coding.
Yeah.
And you've just like, you're processing as you're typing and like you're thinking in code, you're in the zone, and then your last like 2 or 3 lines gone because.
Yeah. Or especially like if you're looking over to the side at something when you're typing.
Oh, yeah.
And you look back and you've lost, you know, a minute of work. And that doesn't seem like a big deal, except that to recover that, you got to figure out where you were and then get back in that head and you got to dismiss the stupid message. Mm-hmm. The other thing that will happen is, let's say that you're typing and you hit enter. If it's a pop-up dialogue and that enter means something, you just agreed to something without reading it. I think this is what happens with a lot of people that are getting burned by Windows updates, besides the ones that where they just force it on you, is they'll be working on something and they get hit and it says, okay, cool, I can update now. But the thing is you pop something up in front of them and nailed them with it. Now, this also hits you in websites, and it's a little different because, like, let's say that you're bringing up a website on your phone. What you want is for the website to load up and have everything laid out immediately, you know, even if the images aren't loaded. What you don't want is to, you know, load the images one by one as you're going through, because it redoes the layout. And so the user can go to click on something and they click on something they didn't want because you moved the layout under the mouse cursor as they were clicking.
Oh, yeah. This has happened a lot on my iPad mini.
Yeah.
I absolutely hate it. And there are certain websites I will not go to.
Yeah, because they're unusable.
And what the other thing is, like, they'll load everything. Like, they'll do lazy load and, like, all the content will pop up and I'll be, like, halfway through reading something.
And it bumps you back up to the top.
Or it just crashes because something in their JavaScript errored.
Yeah.
And the whole page goes down. Like, I can't read their content because of that. And I'm like, all right, I will never visit your site again.
You know, the thing is you are building websites that respond to user input. That's focused to your app or to a control in your app. And when you switch that out from under the user, that's bad.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's now you're not expressing intent. And from a legal perspective, this is what malware does as well. Yeah. Like, you can pop up something and make somebody click on it by mistake and you've got them. This is how, you know, things like clickjacking work too. Like, this is not a good behavior for software just in general. Like, you don't want this going on.
Finally, poor settings management. Your users would generally like your app to remember the settings they used last time.
Visual Studio Code. I'm sorry. I got a nasty cough.
I don't know why you have problems with that, because I think you're just setting it up wrong.
I don't know, man. WordWrap and Visual Studio Code, every single time I open a podcast episode outline, I have to hit Alt-Z to put the WordWrap back on.
Is that how you turned it on originally?
I turned it on in the settings originally, but it, you know.
Did you go back? When you updated it last, did you go back and check your settings?
No. Well, and that's still poor management,
right? That is poor management, but they did send out a thing that you needed to check your
settings. Yeah, but I don't read their things.
Well, I know.
Like, they should have popped it up and said, hey, yo, dog, we broke all the things, so you're going to have to fix the things.
The next update actually fixed that, but if you didn't go back and... It was one of those things, it was like, oopsie kind of thing. But,
well, they've had a few oopsie updates here lately anyway.
Well, it has to do with, you know, Microsoft trying to do continuous integration.
Yeah.
And, like, roll out an update every month, at least one update every month, sometimes two, if their update breaks stuff.
Yeah.
I usually stay a month behind simply because I wait to see if they roll out.
Because they still let you.
Yeah.
That's why you do it, unlike Windows. The other thing that is really annoying with this is stuff that remembers passwords. Like my little app that I use for tracking my to-do list, which includes like my grocery list, Nosby, they've done this to me a couple times with updates where they'll push an update and it forgets that I have, hey, remember my password. Well, the reason I remember my password is there's nothing critical in there. It's my freaking grocery list. And so what happens? Oh, my phone updated overnight. I put stuff in my grocery list on my computer, right? I grab the phone, put it in the belt clip. I drive to Costco 20 minutes away, and then I get there and then I have to come home because I don't have the password because I'm using a password manager.
I remember I was there when that happened.
And like that kind of stuff, like that's an hour round trip that just was wasted.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, it's like, my wife can't get into my password manager. So if the password's not there, like I'm just screwed. Mm-hmm. And that's not something that should ever happen. And if you can't migrate the settings, you don't have the right to change how they're stored.
I mean, if it was something that you're doing like a major update.
Yeah. But it has to, you know, again, this goes with the auto update practices.
Yeah. It shouldn't be auto if it's like that major of an update.
Right. Because it's like, look, you're going to break things and you don't know what your users are going to be doing.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't do that. And I mean, I chewed them out on tech support. I'm like, this happens again. And last time it happened, I was like, look, this happens again. I'm switching my to-do list app and I'm not paying y'all anymore. You know, that was a lot of money and time because I had to come all the way back here, get my password, put it back on the phone, and then drive back.
I remember when I was with you and that happened, we tried to remember as much stuff as we could. And then we got back and
had like three or four things. And it was stuff that I had to go all the way back to Costco for.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was not okay. Words were spoken.
That's true.
And they were not friendly words. Let me tell you, like, you know, that this is when you start talking about somebody's, like, the personal habits of their members of their family line, their, you know, their personal hygiene and, you know, projections of, you know, what they do in their spare time. and, you know, like where they're going after they depart this world, you know, like that doesn't put your users in a good mood. So don't do it. Now, there is one exception to this.
Okay.
This is what I think may have burned them on Nosby. Let's say that you are using password hashing, which you should be, or you should get hit in the face. Like, you shouldn't be storing passwords, even, you know, encrypted. Like, that's not cool. Let's say you're using password hashing and you use an algorithm and something comes out and you go, hey, turns out that there's a way to compromise this algorithm. And it makes things like rainbow table attacks and all that kind of stuff easier. Well, you don't have the password anymore. You have a hash of the password. Yeah. So what do you do? Well, you put another, you put a column in there that says, okay, have they updated the password? Because, hey, this is a security, security issue and you got to fix it. But you can still go, hey, you need to figure out some way to go, all right, some people may want to just use this insecure for the next day versus, oh, no, we have to change this right now. Because, hey, you might really screw somebody over. And, if you have a password manager and you're following proper security procedures, it really doesn't hurt you that much. Because, ooh, you took my, 40-character random generated password. Congratulations, you have noise. And you could put something on my grocery list. You could make me buy low-fat ricotta cheese.
I'm going to do that. I'm going to hack into USB and make you buy low-fat ricotta cheese.
And the thing is this screws over the users that are most likely to be power users.
Yeah.
But, sometimes you have to do that. Like, we're having to do that with an app that we did for a client because, there's more stringent security requirements now. But the other thing we do is they're sitting at a computer and they have an onboarding process and all this stuff to make that as non-painful as possible when the switch happens versus I'm at the store with my phone and I have no recourse. Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess I could have I probably could have gotten SSH working and then like SSH'd into a box here and then remoted over. I'm sure I could get RDP plus SSH working on my phone and then write the password down on a piece of paper and then type it in on the phone. But yeah. Like, that's not okay. So, definitely avoid doing stuff like that.
Yeah, because the password manager that you have is pretty stringent.
Yeah. And I have I reset the passwords automatically and all this stuff. Like, I'm following best practices on security. Mm-hmm. And so, screwing me like that for security that flies all over me.
So, programming errors are one thing. But there are other types of errors that can be just as damaging to the end user experience. And these errors are easy to miss in a software development shop, especially because of the biases that are present on a typical development team. Your QA is not going to catch a lot of these because they're designed to test certain scenarios. And, if those scenarios don't include, a sudden power outage in the middle of testing, they're not going to catch that kind of an error. And a lot of these others are those types of things. And these are things that you need to be thinking about when you're designing and architecting your software. That pretty much wraps us up. Before we close everything out, Will, what do you have for us this week for Tricks of the Trade?
Well, this is something you may not have seen before, although you probably have one somewhere in a design document, and that is the concept of a user persona. And so you have multiple different kinds of users that are using your app. Basically, what you want to do is kind of make a dossier of their attributes. Like, what are they using your app for? What's their technological level of experience? If they have disabilities, those kind of things. And it's basically an idea of, here's what I expect a user of this type to do. And then when you're building a feature, you go, okay, how would this user react to this feature? So if you make some really complicated wizard or some kind of configuration screen and one of your users is grandma, what happens? If you've built things with this in mind, what it tends to do is it forces you out of the mindset of building things for developers and for techies and more into the mindset of, okay, how can my users actually do something with my software? I think this is a really great concept. Again, it's probably not used as much by actual developers as it is in the early phases of the design, but it will help you get your head around what the users might actually use the software, like the way that they'll use it versus you testing it. I guess that pretty much wraps it up. That's all I got.
Stand by for Titanfall.
If you have a question or comment for us, please email us at neckbeards@completedeveloperpodcast.com.
Our theme music is an excerpt from Stand By for Titanfall by Pure Bells, available on SoundCloud and licensed under Creative Commons. The intro music for IoTs is Hillbilly Hip Hop by Jason Belcher. For references, show notes, and to sign up to our email list, be sure and check out the website at CompleteDeveloperPodcast.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at CompleteDevPod and like our page on Facebook to keep up with the news about the show. Thanks for listening. See you next time.